I guess our passion for it started when we moved back here, and then sort of couldn't found it difficult to buy the food that we wanted to be eating ourselves, and so we sort of got around that by making our own bread, and here we are in an area where a lot of food is produced, and it's hard to source good nutritional food here than say in Melbourne, where it's just being all sort of funneled into there. So yeah, it's really important for us to be able to provide to our community. Every chance we get, we prioritise a local order over a Melbourne order, basically, a Melbourne customer. So yeah, it's just, we're just trying to educate people about the benefits of not just what we produce, but choosing food that is gonna be really good for you, your family, and the family who produced it, and the farm that it was produced on.
The Biological Farming Roundtable podcast helps farmers explore innovative, low-input, regenerative and profitable farming systems. The Biological Farming Roundtable is sponsored by Nutrisoil, an award-winning biological liquid fertiliser made from a big worm farm. Nutrisoil's purpose is to empower farmers to produce life-enriching food. Today's episode is with Father Bob Congdon from Woodstock Farm and his son Ian Congdon from Woodstock Flower in Berrigan, New South Wales. Ian and his wife Courtney met at the University of Melbourne while they were studying landscape management and geography. They both had a passion for agriculture and local food markets and saw farming as a means for environmental restoration and building healthy communities. In 2016, they purchased a new American stone mill. They are now the sole buyers of Woodstock grain and sell the milled flour to bakers, restaurants, shops and families in the local region and across Melbourne. Their flour is as soft as baby's powder and a delight to bake with. Their marketing strategy is simple and effective, and their packaging is stylish and sustainable. What's more exciting is the farm is now moving beyond organic and trialling regenerative pasture cropping. In past episodes, we've talked about closing profit margins and commodity market restraints. These restraints can limit farmers from operating a value-driven farming system that is good for the farmer, the consumer, and the planet. This is a great story to get you thinking, but how could we? This is my conversation with Bob and Ian Congdon. Welcome to the podcast, Bob and Ian.
Great to be here.
It's our pleasure.
Wonderful. Ian, many farmers have had that fleeting thought of marketing their own grain, but only a few have followed through with that thought. What made you and Courtney follow through?
Well, Courtney and I were down in Melbourne at the time. She was studying, and I'd just finished studying, was just working on a little farm just north of Melbourne. And I guess we initially saw, it was a Weekly Times feature about Dad's Oats, which is a family, I think, out in the Wimmera, that they'd been growing oats for years and years, and the kids were also down at Melbourne. They'd been to uni and done marketing and all sorts of stuff, and they thought, well, they started getting the oats processed and direct selling. We saw them at farmers markets and stuff like that, and just thought, well, that there could be something in this, but we're growing really good grain up at the farm and not necessarily getting value for it or even eating it ourselves. At the time, we were sort of finding it hard to buy good bread and stuff like that. Just thought, well, why don't we use our grain? And we were also sort of thinking, we thought about meat and stuff as well at the start. I thought maybe we could, that all just seemed a bit too involved and being a long way from what we saw as the biggest markets at the time. So yeah, and then we bought ourselves a little domestic mill, started making just flour for ourselves and using it and loved it. And then we started going to farmers markets, and we're getting lots of demand through there. And basically, yeah, we just started really small and just dabbled. I think that was because we were in a position, we had time, like Court and I weren't super busy with other things at the time, whereas a lot of farmers are busy farming and so don't actually have that opportunity to even just sit down and do the maths on it, and then just to chase after something that you're not even we had no idea what would come of it. We just thought, oh, well, we may as well. And so that was probably the main reason why, just having that time and knowing that it was a really good product that was just could go anywhere. We made us want to do it.
Joel Salatin reminded us in the last podcast that storytelling is key to being able to sell your trade. So how do you communicate to your customers the story of your product?
We have a few ways. The main way probably is through Instagram, where we put up our photos and just little captions. We get good feedback from people sharing what they've used, and we share the cakes they've made and things like that. We also have a really open gate policy. Anyone wants to come up and have a look at what we're doing, we're always more than happy to have people drop in and have a cup of tea and some scones and see the mill and see what we're doing. And then another thing is actually we deliver a lot of our product directly to the bakers or the end user. So it's that gives us a really good opportunity to talk with the customer about what's going on at the farm, whether they can expect supply to be short or good in the next year and things like that. So yeah, it's just, but definitely Instagram has been really important. Yeah, like when we first started, we found this whole new world of baking and milling, and that was basically through Instagram. We would just follow someone who we'd heard about, and then we'd see what they're doing and who they're getting grain from, and what's happening over in the States is a really great movement that we're sort of following on from over there. So yeah, Instagram's been really important to us.
So your market research really was farmers markets?
Yeah, we started going to a few different markets down in Melbourne and then Tallaroook and the Gambie, and yeah, just seeing what people wanted and what they would use it for. And it was actually at one of those markets that Pippa James from Tivoli Road Bakery, they had a stall there, and she came up and started talking to us and said, you know, we use a ton of flour a week, would you be able to do that? And we said, no way. But that was sort of what sowed the seed to think, well, it's actually, there's more than just a small demand for this sort of stuff. People really want to, and bakers really want to know where they get their flour from are doing good things for the earth, are doing good things for their community, and that they're supporting farmers and millers that are doing good work.
So your small milling that you and Courtney had, the mill that you had at home, what made you upscale? When did you upscale? What was involved?
Well, at the end of 2016, I think, we came back up to the farm. It was sort of then that we decided we couldn't keep doing our little farmer's market thing because it was a 3-hour trip to the markets down in Melbourne. We sort of decided, well, there is this demand and we've got enough grain at the moment. Hopefully we can grow more. And so we decided that we worked out a few more things, visited a few more millers and bakers. And we had another baker at Trenton, John Reed. He said, if you mill flour, we'll buy it, basically. Then it came down to like what mill we would choose. And there's a few different stone mills available, but not many. And then we'd heard rumours about these guys up in Vermont in the US who were making stone mills from natural granite. And the flour that was coming out of them was just unlike anything that was available in Australia. So without even seeing one of these, we trusted someone in Australia, Emily Savakel and Chris Duffy in South Australia. They were getting one, and we said, all right, well, if you're getting one, that's good enough for us. And we put in an order for this machine that we'd never actually seen, and we got it probably 8 months later. It took that long for the waiting list, and he hand-built them all. So yeah, fair effort. But it finally came out, and yeah, it really does. Just the quality of the flour that this new American stone mill does is just, yeah, it's just like baby powder. And so that's been the big point for us, having that really fine, good flour.
I've heard that ancient organic grains could be better for our health. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I think things like ancient grains can be a bit buzzwordy, but there's definitely a lot of anecdotal evidence that people can digest things like spelt, which is meant to be have an unchanged genome from sort of 2,000 years ago. They can digest that much easier than a lot of modern wheat varieties. And some say that's sort of due to co-evolving with something like that. And it is a really nice grain, but I think it could be more about actually having whole grain flour that you're not throwing away the most nutritious parts of the grain, which is the germ and the bran, which normally gets thrown out in white flour, goes to animal feed. Organic grains, I think it's just a lot safer just to know that there's nothing that we don't trust in it. I mean, it's a tried and tested way of farming that has sustained people forever. So we don't want to mess with that and don't want to put something into our system that we don't know what it'll do to the soil or to us in 10, 20 years time, something like that.
Bob, can we talk about how the organic grain is grown? How long have you been organic for?
Oh, it's about 25 years now, yeah.
So how do you grow it?
Started off just growing it the way my dad did, like we'd plow the paddocks and sow it and do all that, but then that works, but we're trying to move away from ploughing all the time to working the soil, so now we're doing a bit more direct drilling into stubble, growing a crop of rye or something after wheat or oats into a stubble. And that has mixed success rates, but you've got to just get it right and then it works. If you can get it right, it'll work. So that's what we're doing, yeah. So
it sounds like you're doing lots of trial at the moment. So first of all, the transition was ploughing instead of using chemicals, but now you're using cover crops and stubble.
We're sort of trialing multi-species work too, so we're putting a bit more grains together, so that'll involve probably having to clean them because people don't want grains mixed together generally. So we're trying to do our first crop into an established perennial grass pasture, so that hopefully that's one that doesn't have too much rye grass in it, so you have to get rid of the rye grass and have a good cover of grass when you sow. That seems to be your best chance of getting a good establishment. So it's risky.
But it's also not that risky because it's only one pass.
It's not.
You're only putting in grain. And so you're putting in 70 kilos to the hectare of rye and nothing else. And if it doesn't go that well, you might have slightly increased the grazing because of that rye.
It's good feed.
So you haven't, we're not losing out a lot when that crop doesn't work. And we've been, the last couple of years it hasn't worked, but it hasn't cost us huge amounts. So it is risky, as in it might not, it's risky for a miller, so I'm not definitely going to get grain, but for the farmer, it's not quite as risky, which is nice.
So I see the vision here is going beyond organic, going into regenerative organic.
Yeah, I think so.
Organic's not necessarily be all and end all, it's about sustainability and regenerative farming.
And pasture cropping is sort of the flavour I'm hearing.
Pasture cropping's a big part of it, yeah. We've listened to a lot of Colin Sice talks and Christine
Jones,
yeah.
So what happens if you get some type of disease? What do you do when you're in organic system?
Well, you can just try and pick up the general health of your plants, so that's when we would use Nutrasoil, some other boosting product like that, if you're finding your plants are going to need an issue, but it hasn't been a big problem, not something we think we're going to have to face.
So what do you sow, when you're sowing, what do you use? Do you use a product or nothing?
Yeah, we've used Nutrasoil for 2 years now as a seed dressing. Seed dressings, I think, make a big difference in just the rate that you can get a crop up. And when you're trying to beat the weeds, getting a crop up makes a big difference. So you put fair bit of moisture on with the seed dressing, and it seems to gets the seeds up and going. They think they're already planted before you put them in the ground, and they start growing earlier. And that seems to be able to get a crop up in a few days. You can get a crop out of the ground. Yeah, you try and get it in front of the ryegrass.
And what about a foliar application?
Yeah, we'll do a foliar application. We've done one this year at the three leaf stages in the cereals, and then there'll be another one later in the spring.
Yeah.
Hopefully that'll really boost it up and get it going. We just need a bit more rain.
Yes. Do you do tissue tests or soil tests? Are you following any of those type of things?
Not really. I mean, I got a few soil tests done as part of where I've got a little native grass plot that we're going to try and establish through a land care project with Cora Land Care and also Yakua Indigenous group from Denny. Yeah, so we got some base soil tests done there, but we haven't had a lot done apart from that.
Yeah, I used to do soil tests 20 years ago, but I found that you're probably better off to buy fertilisers instead.
So is there any sort of restrictions that you have in this soil that you think that you need to address, or you really feel like nature just sorts itself out?
I think we've still got a long way to go with our soils. A little bit more of an open, softer, friable soil, I think, where we can get a little bit more growth out of it. I think just by getting our grazing right and going away from our ploughing, we might go a long way towards that.
And the native grasses.
Yeah, and trying to establish those perennials as much as we can. We've got a few good paddocks established nicely with things like rigid panic and what else is there? There's lots of windmill grasses and
wallaby grass
and things like that. So we're seeing a lot of those come back. Yeah, there's been no artificial nitrogen or anything that for the last 20 years. So if you don't plough it, it pretty quickly seems to favour those native grasses.
How long did it take since you stopped ploughing over your fallow system? How long did that take to get those natives back again?
Not that long. Like, if you just leave it alone for 5 or 6 years, you'll have a fair coverage. But you also have to do the grazing right. That's where the rotational grazing can make a big difference. Like, if you're giving longer rest periods and the shorter grazings. So it's about having as many stock together in the one mob you can make and keep them moving.
Do you use electric wires to do that, or just...?
We've done that. It gets a bit labour-intensive to do much of it, because you will spend 2 hours every day shifting fences. But, we just need to put more permanent fences in, so we don't have to be doing as much. So they're only short runs if you've got to do electric fences.
Yeah, a few permanent electric fences, sort of subdividing the bigger paddocks and water point in the middle. That's where we're heading towards, slowly, with our fencing.
Ian's too busy milling to do much fencing at the moment.
So, Bob, you said that it could take 5 years to get to that good established native grasses. What was the transition like from stopping the ploughing to that five-year period? What weeds came up? How did you manage them?
Just by doing the grazing, holistic or the rotational grazing, just goes so much to helping that happen. As a transition, it's hard to say, because we just have some paddocks that we've done this way and the other paddocks that we'd be ploughing up. So it's just a matter of trying to not come back and plough those paddocks. So you just move off a bit to somewhere else and keep the other ones for the stock.
How do you choose your grains to grow? Who chooses them? Where do you source them?
Well, with the grains we're growing this year, we're growing cereal rye, which we do a lot of direct drilling with, and after a wheat crop, we'll put the rye direct drilled into the stubble. Dad's been growing that for 20 years, probably, or longer, 25.
Yeah.
Is that just for a cover crop?
No, that's for, we mill it as well, and we sell it as rye flour, and I think Australians should eat more rye bread because it's such a good crop to grow.
From a farmer's perspective.
And for a miller, I always want to sell more rye because that's what we can grow probably the most sustainably. And then with the wheat, we've got two different varieties of wheat that we're growing on a larger scale this year, which is Spitfire and Rosella. So the Spitfire is a It's a more modern variety from about 2007, like a dwarf, and it is a fairly high protein, which it works really well as a bread flour. So that's our high protein bread flour. And then we grow Rosella, which is probably an older variety from the 80s or maybe a little bit earlier than that. And it was grown as a biscuit wheat. And it's a really, it makes a really gorgeous light cake and biscuits, and you can even use it in bread. Great scone, perfect for scone. And so that's our two different wheat varieties at the moment. And then we're growing a couple of ancient grains, if you want to call them that.
What makes them ancient?
Ancient, well, spelt is from, they reckon that the spelt genome is unchanged from 2,000 years ago, and they've dug it up and found samples in tombs and whatever else that hasn't changed. I mean, it's a pain to grow. Well, it's not too bad to grow, but it's a pain to harvest and mill because it holds on to its husk, kind of like an oat. It has to be dehulled before it's milled, which is a lengthy, well, just a difficult process. And it costs us about $750 a ton to take the husk off it by the time we've transported it. So that means spelt flour is expensive, but it's a really, it's an established market for spelt. People really, and it is a really tasty, useful grain for milling and eating. And then we also grow Corazon, which is supposed to be out of the Corazon province of what's now Iran. And it's, yeah, so meant to be an older variety. Just the flavour from that grain is really amazing. It's just really malty, almost chocolatey, someone said the other day. But yeah, it's really strong in flavour. Doesn't perform quite as well as some of the others in baking, but it's really flavoursome. So the reason we're growing those ancient varieties is demand. There's lots of market demand for them. And then the rye, we're mainly growing because it works really well. And there's, we can always sell it too. People are looking for organic rye. But we would like to get towards maybe a higher biomass wheat varieties that we can choose really for their flavour and their milling properties and their baking properties. So we have a few trials at the moment where we're growing little plots, like 6 metres by 6 metres of hand-sown wheat varieties that we got some seed from the gene bank. So we got like 100 seeds and planted them out last year, harvest them, hand thresh and re-sow. So it's very labour intensive if we want to get these different varieties. But there are other people growing out these interesting old varieties. And so hopefully we can together work out things that will work here on this farm for all of our different purposes.
So when you're actually sourcing the grain, you can't go and buy a ton of grain. You actually have to buy a small amount and grow it out yourself.
Yeah, for some of these older varieties, that, and even then we don't even know, we can't mill them until 4 or 5 years later when we've got enough. So it's a long process before we even know whether they're suitable. But we're just sort of going on historical records and stuff like that at the moment. But for some of the other varieties, where like the reason we have Spitfire is because Dad could find a grower who had Spitfire at that time when we wanted a new wheat variety. So the choice is definitely restricted being organic. And when you're looking for something that to grow in a system that isn't what a lot of these varieties are bred for. So I guess if something is bred under a high input system for specific traits such as disease resistance in that system of high inputs and then high yield, it may not do those things here on our farm, say if we put it in a pasture cropping scenario. So yeah, we're interested in having a diversity of grains, so being grown by lots and lots of different people so that we can find what's best for us.
You're very proactive in doing your own market research, and it really is that you're having to do it yourself. And you've got this amazing connection being the baker or the miller and the grower. You know what works well in the mill. You know what the bakers are asking for. So you're quite leaders in this area.
Yeah, well, it's there's a lot of other people who are doing really good work as well in this sort of area, but it definitely comes from having those relationships. So for us, it's pretty easy to have a relationship between the farmer and the miller.
guaranteed market.
But and then having the bakers as well for the final feedback on the product, it's really, really important, and it's completely sort of changed my idea about what we should be growing and how we should be going about it, I guess. It really reinforces how people do care about things more than just price when it comes to food. So it's worth working at.
Do you feel isolated because you don't have that research support and you're working it all out yourself, or is there a community that you have?
Don't have that many. I suppose we have our Riverina Organic Farmers group that we get together and talk about things at times, but they're not necessarily doing a lot of this sort of stuff either. So it's, we sort of just, we get a bit used to it.
But I think in this space that's, it's probably more focused on the baking area. And there's a real movement sort of building, and people, there's sort of academics and plant breeders, and there's a lot more interest coming from different areas now. I think it's starting to become, it's quite inclusive, this little movement of people who are trying to build a local grain economy, which is sort of how they term it. And yeah, it's actually quite exciting to be a part of and to be within it.
That would be, motivation and drive to be in such an exciting space.
Yeah, I think so.
Does the organic price point compensate for all this extra work you're doing?
He probably got his grain a bit cheaper this year than I could have sold it somewhere, but generally that's because the price went silly this year when there's not much about.
Yeah.
When we negotiated it, it was good. But it was based on
enough price.
So but we pay a set price for what we grow, but it's based on the cost of production. And in our system, it's not based on other people's costs of production that we have to try and beat. So that's where our direct marketing can control it can sort of support the way we grow and the way we want to grow, rather than forcing us to grow to a certain price point, basically. So
essentially this is a family business. Is it separate, the growing and the milling? Do you have your own business plan each?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're just like attached. Our business is just a separate business that just we just we run it like that. We just work from buying grain off mum and dad who do their farm business. But yeah, it's definitely blurry at times when we like making decisions and growing crops and stuff like that. That's all.
What's the biggest challenge in being an organic grain grower, Bob?
Oh, probably your weed battle is always just getting your crop ahead of the weeds is the biggest issue. You can't just, if you get it wrong, you can't just go to the shop and buy a chemical that'll sort out your problem for you. You've got to wear it. You find another way, you can make it into hay or sheep feed, or you just sort of put up with it.
Yeah, change your attitude.
Change your
so
attitude.
So that weeds aren't as scary.
Just that it doesn't yield as well as if you've got too many weeds. That's all.
And you also have organic sheep. What's different about sheep husbandry in an organic system?
Well, we don't drench. We do use dips, and we've got one we can use for the
extinosad
for flies and lice if we have a lice problem. We haven't had to dip sheep for a long time now. Drenching is a good thing not to have to do, but the main difference that made the sheep work was when we changed to the rotational grazing. Because you've got a bigger plant, you've got more fibre in the plant, and it's better feed. So all the time before that, when you've got sheep on too short a pasture, they're getting worms and it runs through them and they get scoury, and we used to use loose lambs to worms and things like that, but that'll stop when you get the rotational grazing right.
Is it difficult to manage your sheep holistically in the drought when you're organic? You can't trade them in and out as easily as a normal trading system. What do you do?
Well, you can trade them out pretty quick. Gotta get a truck. That was sort of the biggest issue we've had in the last 12 months, is that we just didn't think it was going to be as tight as it turned out to be, so we didn't unload as quickly as we needed to.
But that could possibly be because we can't buy in as easily.
suppose we don't.
So you're restricted. You start to think, maybe we'll just hold on to a few because it's going to be difficult to rebuy.
You can still buy stock in the organic system, just you can't buy ewes that are pregnant if they're past their third trimester and use those lambs as an organic lamb. You have to have their lambs organically from their third trimester of the pregnancy.
Right, so you can still buy sheep in that aren't organic and then transition them in through the organic system when they're lambing.
We tend not to. We usually just breed and retain them.
I was going to say, you've never bought sheep that I can remember, apart from rams. So,
is there anything surprisingly easy about being organic?
Paying the chemical bill's pretty easy.
So, do you think that it's profitable?
We make a bit of money.
Yeah.
We make a huge money, but we make a bit.
But your inputs would be a lot lower.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely lower input costs.
Have you ever questioned changing back again?
Never.
Ian, you're passionate about building a local food system in the region. What drives your passion? And Courtney, you're both.
Yeah, Courtney's a big driver in what we do. But our passion for it started when we moved back here and then sort of found it difficult to buy the food that we wanted to be eating ourselves. And so we sort of got around that by making our own bread. And here we are in an area where a lot of food is produced and it's hard to source good nutritional food here than, say, Melbourne, where it's just being all sort of funneled into there. So, it's really important for us to be able to provide to our community. And we're really working towards trying to, every chance we get, we prioritise a local order over a Melbourne order, basically, a Melbourne customer. So, we're just trying to educate people about the benefits of not just what we produce, but choosing food that is going to be really good for you, your family, and the family who produced it, and the farm that it was produced on.
You and Courtney run sourdough cooking classes. What benefits does sourdough have over your normal supermarket bread?
Well, the best benefit, I think, is that it just tastes like something. And it feels like something once you've eaten it. You can have, one slice of bread for breakfast and it feels like you've actually eaten. That's a big benefit. But then also the way that it is made, it happens sort of over a period of 12 to 24 hours. And in that time, so many different enzymes and bacterias and yeasts are all working in there together to break down a lot of the parts of the plant that we can't digest without that intervention. So by the time that we cook it and eat it, it's much more digestible for us, I think. And anecdotally, a lot of people say the same thing. And then if your sourdough is whole grain, it's got all the enzymes and fats and flavour that come from the germ. And then it's got the fibre, which comes from the bran. And then also a lot of associated enzymes and flavour. It's just much better for your digestive system to have that fibre. And then it tastes good because of all your flavours that are in those parts of the grain kernel.
The word gluten is a key word that a lot of people don't quite understand. Could you explain to us what gluten is?
Yeah, so gluten is a protein. I think it's got two parts. It occurs in cereal grains, but mostly in wheat is the highest in gluten, and that's why we use it for making bread. And so the gluten is a protein that forms the... It means that bread dough can be stretchy and elastic and therefore can hold on to gas bubbles and therefore be airy and light. And those gas bubbles hold all the flavour in the bread as well. So the gluten is what makes bread bread. But without gluten or with low gluten, you can still... With low gluten grains like our Rosella that we grow, it's only about 9% protein. Which gluten is that's sort of a test for gluten, is the protein level, especially in wheat. But it can still make really good bread, even at 9%. If you do a slow, gentle ferment, you don't need to have really high levels of gluten, whereas your commercially industrial made bread that you might find in the supermarket, they'll often add gluten. So they would extract gluten from flour or from wheat and then add it, extra gluten in, so that it can happen really quick and really fast and get a really big fluffy light loaf of bread. But that gluten hasn't been subjected to any or very short period of fermentation, and only by one single strain of yeast. So it hasn't been pre-digested for us, and that it can be difficult to digest. And I think that that's why a lot of us don't all get uncomfortable stomachs and stuff from eating too much gluten, and why there's been a movement away from gluten. But I think it shouldn't be thought of as a bad guy. And I think there's a lot of good bakers out there that are showing that gluten is good.
So essentially it's the longer fermentation and the microbes that pre-digest the gluten for us, which makes it easier for us to digest?
Yeah, so the gluten and a lot of the other things that are in the flour. So it's sort of like a ruminant has microbes in their stomach that can break down that cellulose and that allows them to get energy from it. Well, we don't have any of those. The sourdough culture has a lot of microbes in it that can do that digesting work for us in the bowl, in the dough before we bake it and eat it. So yeah, sourdough bread is the best way for us to get energy from a plant, basically.
Where do you sell the bread? Where can people buy it?
Well, we don't actually bake and sell bread, but we sell flour in the local Berrigan Cafe, the Blue Door Cafe. You can get flour.
I saw it there yesterday.
Yeah, you can buy flour from Essential Ingredient in Albury, Border Just Foods in Albury. And then we sell a lot of Nikki, bicycle baker in Albury, she uses our flour to make sourdough bread. Then we have a few other bakers in Melbourne and in Trentham. And our flour is available online through our online shop. Yeah, just search Woodstock Flour.
www.woodstock.com?
Just woodstockflour.com.
Woodstock
Flour. Yeah, www.woodstockflour.com, I think, is us.
Are you able to provide enough grain for the mill?
We didn't last year, but luckily we had enough stored that we can get through to harvest. But we'll need a harvest this year.
Yeah.
Otherwise we'll be having to look for grain, look for wheat.
But you have a guaranteed market straight into the mill.
Yeah. So, and the good thing about it, like, we're flexible in what we're doing with the flour. So if we don't have a very good harvest this year, we'll reduce our sort of wholesale to bakeries and maintain our retail. So we'll still be selling in the 5 kilo bags and focusing on those and just supplying a smaller community. Yeah, so we're kind of flexible to a point, but we will need grain at some point.
So let's just hope we have a good season this year, Bob.
Just get us some rain, we'll be right.
It's already looking better than
year. We just need that bit more rain to get it, keep it going, finish off when the spring dries out a bit.
And what about the classes, Ian? How can people get involved in them, the sourdough cooking classes?
The best way, we don't have any sort of scheduled too far ahead, but the best way is to join our mailing list. So you can do that by visiting our website and then joining our mailing list, and then we'll let anyone know, everyone on that mailing list know when what we've got coming up. And also our Instagram, if anyone wants to follow us on Instagram, Woodstock Flour.
Wonderful.
That's us, yeah, so.
What a great story. Paddock to plate, pretty much, is what this story is. So fantastic effort, Bob and Ian and Courtney, who's with Mabel today, can't be on the podcast with little two-year-old running around. So thank you. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you, Carl.
Please follow the Biological Farming Roundtable podcast. Share it with your friends and networks. I'm Nicola Maddick and I work at Nutrisoil, a liquid biological fertiliser made from a big worm farm whose purpose is to empower farmers to produce life-enriching food.